very exciting. Thank you all for coming. There are so many of you. And it's going to be a really exciting evening. So thank you. Can you hear me if I speak like this? I'm slightly breathy, but as I get going, my voice will come in. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, this is Liars League. Give me a cheer if you've been here before. And give me a cheer if this is your first time. Even Stevens. And Stevenesses. All right. So, this is Liars League, where writers write, actors read, audience listens, and everyone wins. This is the third Women and Girls Liars League. This might come as a surprise to some of us, because we stay women or girls more or less throughout the year. We don't transform like a werewolf once and then wake up tomorrow like a formless blob. But thanks to Hannah Gadsby's Nanette, that is as far as that analogy will go, because the law of self-deprecation is over!
Yes!
Thank you. The Troubarist Marie de France wrote in the 12th century, "When a truly beneficial thing is heard by many people, it then enjoys its first blossom. But if it is widely praised, its flowers are in full bloom." Tonight's stories are ready for wide and bounteous blooming praise, and we are so glad to be able to share them with you this evening. So that there are no interruptions, please now turn all of your mobiles, pages, etc. to silent. There were nearly 70 submissions this month, and the shortlist was pored over until our six mighty stories were settled on. We have authors hailing from the US, Australia, Ireland, and the UK. The first half will have three of our stories, and then there will be an interval and the infamous Liars League quiz.
Ooh.
Excellent. Yes. Leave gap for ooze. And then three more stories before we send you off into the night. Now, I've taken a bit of a risk here, and I've written a puntro. So, here you go. Okay. Thank you all for rolling in here sober. We're Sappho pleased, Pluff, you found us. After looking at your map, Shelley, you couldn't have got lost. To be bluntly honest, tonight is going to be ostentatious. We're going to keep the wolf from the door, make sure we can see the Atwoods for the trees, because Sadie days have come again. I don't give a Dickinson whether you know your Wollstonecraft from your Walker. No one will think any lessing of you. To me, you're all Angelus. So de Beauvoir sakes, before we all go mantle, without further ado, Morris on. Thank you. Our first story of the night will be Ray, read by Miranda Harrison. Ray is by Sadie Knott. Sadie began writing in 2014 and is a research psychologist by background. She's working on her Seville novel. Sadie, how's your Seville novel going? Is it going well? Good. And your second novel? Her short fiction has appeared in Lost Lit, The Selkie, and The Book of Godless Verse. She lives in South London, where she watches garden foxes with admiration and trepidation. All will become revealed. Miranda Harrison is reading a story. Her credits include More Than This at the Bread and Roses, Women Redressed at the Arcola, The Mesmer at Dirty Dick Vaults, and some classics. She played the nurse in Romeo and Juliet at the Leicester Square Theatre, Mother in Blood Wedding at Baron's Court, and her voiceover work includes BBC Children in Need, charity and corporate narrations, educational audio also. Miranda also runs new writing event, Page to Stage. Welcome to the stage, Miranda Harrison.
The hood of Jessie's parka was pulled forward, so it was not until she was nearly home that she caught her first glimpse of him. A huge ginger tom stretched out in their window box. He was squashing the purple crocuses her mum, Dawn, had planted there. A bit of nature to counteract all the car fumes, Dawn had said. When Jessie opened the gate, she realised with a start it was not a cat at all. The fox opened one eye. Jessie took off her rucksack and held it protectively across her chest. You could tell from the size of him that it was a male fox. Jangle of Jessie's keys didn't seem to faze him. She wanted to shoo him away, but Something about him made her hesitate. Brazen. That's what Nan would have called him, if she was still around. This animal business was like a game. Like the game, What's the Time, Mr. Wolf? Jessie thought. You stand with your back to the world and the world creeps up. You look round, but nothing moves. You turn your back again, and suddenly the creeping thing is right there, inches away from your face. Before the fox arrived, it had only been happening in the back garden. It began with the bird feeder Dawn had hung from the rusty spin-around washing line left behind by the people who previously lived in the house. Pigeons arrived first, strutting around the scrubby lawn. Blue tits waited in the bushes and flitted in the minute the pigeons flew away. Dawn bought more feeders and filled them to the brim with seed mix and fat balls. Squirrels with threadbare tails were tempted out of the beech trees that stood at the very end of the common behind the garden. The squirrels undid the lids of the supposedly squirrel-proof feeders, scattering the bird food onto the grass. Dawn had a notebook she kept open on the kitchen table, where she sat half the day, watching the wildlife through the patio door. She listed each creature she saw. 13th of March 2019. Seven pigeons. First ever goldfinch. Next door's cat. Three squirrels. A magpie. One for sorrow. One rat. A rat? For God's sake, Mum, said Jessie when she came in from school and saw the list. They're all God's creatures, said Dawn, as if there was no difference between a goldfinch and a rat. Jessie stopped going in the garden after that, even though it was a good place to smoke. Next door's cat and the rat, or was it rats, appeared more frequently in the notebook entries after Dawn tried to entice a hedgehog into the garden with saucers of cat food. And now, this fox had appeared, lounging like a king on his crocus bed. Later that evening, when Jessie came into the kitchen to say goodnight to Dawn, there was a fox-shaped shadow sitting outside the patio door. That's Reynard, said Dawn, gazing through the glass, a Mona Lisa smile on her face. The tulips, which had replaced the crocuses, were starting to go over. Their red petals splayed open or dropped. When Jessie came home each day, the house felt different. She couldn't figure out what had changed. Perhaps it was Dawn, who'd taken to humming tunes Jessie didn't recognise. They were cheerful tunes and better than the usual silence. Jessie sat on the sofa to watch telly. A dark orange hair, tipped black at one end and snowy white at the other, lay on the cushion. Jessie held the wiry hair between her fingers and went through the kitchen to show Dawn. Look what's been in here, she said. You need to keep the patio door shut. Said Dawn distractedly. A day later, Jessie found not just a hair on the sofa, but the whole of Reynard, sitting upright in Jessie's usual spot. And on the other half of the sofa was Dawn. A spring watch programme about moles was on telly. Dawn and Reynard were engrossed by the scenes on the screen, and neither looked round until Jessie coughed. Reynard's amber eyes rested on Jessie, unblinking. Dawn stroked Reynard's head between his triangular ears. It's okay. It's only Jessie. She won't hurt you. There was a rank odour, like the smell when you walk past the gents, only stronger. When Jessie backed out of the room, Dawn and Reynard resumed their telly-watching. Ray is quite tame, you know, Dawn said when she eventually came upstairs to find Jessie. You'll come to like him. They're really dangerous. Look. Jessie held out her phone to show Dawn. One bit off a baby's finger. You can't believe everything you read on the internet. There's all sorts of rubbish on there. As Dawn left to return to Ray, she said, you know, in Russia, lots of people have them as pets. Not that Ray's a pet. Jessie listened over and over to the playlist she'd named Lonesome. Sam Smith sang Stay With Me. A tear ran down Jessie's cheek. She wiped it away with her sleeve. She wandered downstairs to join Dawn. When Jessie sat in the armchair, Ray gave a low growl from the sofa, where he was lying with his snout on Dawn's knee. Dawn trailed her fingers along his back where the black bristles were blackest. Countryfile was on. A farmer was delivering a lamb with a whoosh of water and blood. Ray looked over at Jessie and licked his lips. The sun blazed down and Jessie was in the garden, digging little holes in the lawn to pass the time, now that it was the summer holidays. Mooching around, Dawn called it. The bird feeders were empty, as was the cat food saucer intended for hedgehogs, so there was no longer any risk of rats. Dawn was only interested in one type of wildlife now. Jessie could see Ray's outline skulking towards the armchair, where he cocked one leg. The whole house smelt of Ray. Ray and fried chicken. The top two shelves of the fridge bulged with a roast chicken, chicken drumsticks, chicken breast pieces, turkey slices, and ready meals of chicken korma, chicken nuggets, and crispy duck pancakes. The bottom shelf contained four long boxes of free-range eggs, leaving a small corner for Jessie's tofu and corn. Ray sat at the table with Dawn, his bushy tail hanging down, curled around one of the chair legs. He was much bigger than before, the largest fox Jessie had ever seen. Perhaps he was fluffing up his coat to give this impression. Maybe it was all the chicken. Jessie took her dinner of tofu chunks and microwaved rice to her bedroom. When Jessie went to clean her teeth before bed, Dawn had just finished washing in the bathroom. Night, Dawn said to Jessie. As Dawn walked into her own bedroom, slinking along by her side was Ray. At breakfast, Ray sat on his usual chair, his auburn paws on the table, dipping his snout into a plate brimming with scrambled eggs. Jessie poured oat milk onto her cornflakes. Dawn took a sip from the mug of coffee she was cradling and placed it down. That was the moment Jessie saw the scratches on Dawn's neck. Four dark red lines close together. Jessie frowned, then raised her eyebrows to ask Dawn what the hell was going on. He was only playing, said Dawn. She spooned more egg onto Ray's plate. Jessie grabbed her parka from the wall and ignored Dawn and Ray as she walked out through the patio door into the garden, trailing her coat behind her. She pulled at the wire around the hole in the back fence, wriggled through the gap onto the common, and walked on and on, all the way to the beech trees at the far end. Jessie laid out her parka and sat on it, her back against a tree trunk, and smoked a cigarette in long drags. She could just make out the house in the distance and the glow of the telly. The hazel fur inside her parka was soft and beckoning. Jessie curled up in a tight ball in the hollow at the base of the tree and pulled her hood over her head.
Doro Boehm, read by Sophie Cartman. Doro Boehm is a visual artist and writer. Her work has appeared in You Journal, Canopic Jar Journal, and Nailed Magazine. She has been shortlisted for the Bridport Prize 2018 and received writing fellowships from the Ragdale Foundation and an artist in residency from the Ministry for Science and Culture, Baden-Württemberg. Thank you. Please welcome to the stage Sophie Cartman. She is a Rose Bruford College graduate. She studied American Theatre Arts. Her theatre appearances include the Soho Theatre, ADC, Arcola, the Crucible at Buxton Opera House, and The Secret Life of Sissy Tancock at the Hackney Empire. Her TV, film, and radio credits include Monster, 1983, Evil Never Dies, Suspicion on Discovery ID, a Tokyo drama on BBC Radio 4, and Twirly Wings on CBeebies. Please welcome to the stage Sophie Cartman. Dwarfs Don't Die by Doro Boehm. I smear a slug of Nutella onto a halved Granny Smith. She scatters the animals, the octopus in a sweater, the disemboweled lion, a furry white blood cell holding hands with a glassy-eyed botulism tube, plush toy microbes scaled up from seven zeros and a decimal point to a fist-sized velvet. They'll populate seven hills into forests, threaten Snow White, but won't harm her. Bear went missing last week in the park, but remains present in spirit. We talk about him a lot. There's a unicorn just in case, but realistically, it's too small to court a miracle's nod in Chicago. Mostly, it gets kicked under the bed when she flees from the hunter. And we prop up a creature with appendages so unproportioned and facial features so ill-defined, we've named it Miss BS, because we don't know anyone else by that name. The setup takes as long as the actual play. She can't write yet. Our checklist consists of two rows of drawings, which we work through in silence. I put on a tank top and tights, a multi-purpose costume foundation upon which my assignments can be layered in no time. For the Queen Mother, I lay out my wedding skirt. For the prince, a purple jacket. Over the summer, all he gets is a flower because the air conditioner is still broken. A series of caps turns me into a series of dwarfs. And over the winter, lost headwear grows in abundance along the bike path. Short-stemmed scarves hold up soggy gloves, their woolly fingers spread out like petals. What we find, we hang up on branches and let it dry. Harvest it later, if no one else does. Out comes the comb, the lace torn off an old bra, a knife, and a needle. In the meantime, she has dressed up in her own wedding gown from Goodwill. The bodice cut off, maybe blood, most more likely wine stains. Hemmed in, but wide enough to accommodate two of her size. The skirt trails her and looks no less regal than anything Kate or Meghan would wear. Six fabric rectangles stand in for dwarf beds, and a towel for the seventh fits her size. Raw vegetables spill from the seven small plates, and she'll eat from each one. There's no compromise. The chunks of cooked beets are for me, her liver, her heart. We've tried marshmallows dipped into cocoa, but beets simply look better. For the mirror, we found a glass shelf in the alley, prop it against the back door. And lastly, I prepare the final scene soundtrack. Rite of Spring makes us dance with abandon, in my case, over hot coals. She wants the music to sound creepy, chaotic, with moments where we can catch our breath. Penderecki works, or anyone else born cacophonous east of the Danube. If pressed for time, we take Rat-a-tat's loud pipes, the version with lyrics. I've never heard, I've never
finished by balled up red paper.
Since we last played, her cardboard coffin has been further embellished with glitter and the stickers she swiped from kindergarten. I was told in writing I'd have to admonish her for it. Additional drawings and newspaper clippings have been glued on and collaged over the loot. Most depict death, love, or both, with a bit of Cézanne in between because of his apples. Cut out windows in the lid and the side panels are covered with cellophane. We've Googled funeral inspirations and looked at wicker, wool, and bamboo, but for us, this receptacle works best. It's as close to a glass coffin as we can get and allows the prince to fall in love with his idea of a dead girl's absolute beauty. To transform the apartment's stale city air and elevate it from old factory base camp to fairy tale wonder, I let her sprinkle drops of tea tree oil onto the carpet. The potion's leaves, probably harvested by seven gnomes somewhere in New Zealand. My laptop stays open in case questions arise midway through. We've looked up snow characteristics on the National Snow and Ice Data site and have combed through reports of diseases one can catch when fleeing through forests. If it's a tropical one, Princess and Hunter are threatened by mucosal leishmaniasis. That's why we added our flesh-eating plush toy microbes. We've learned how many women to this day die in childbirth and how unfairly the threat is distributed citywide, globally, and across ethnic divides. Afghanistan is no place to give birth in. Our own neighborhood falls somewhere in the middle. And we've pored over data on how humans behave once they get lost in the wilderness. Without external reference points, we cannot maintain a sense of direction, but instead break into circles and walk their perimeters endlessly. We tend to stay close to where we start from whenever we try to pass through the unknown. And without guideposts, we're stuck. No matter how long we travel and how sincere our efforts are to arrive at someplace new. Yesterday, we glanced at whatmeganwore.net, but she's a duchess, not a princess. Now we're ready. I sit down, pick up my needlework, and look out the rear window. My horizon ends with a high rise behind the parking lot. There aren't any broad plains or expansive vistas my mind could wander and daydream of future pregnancies. I'm a single mother, sewing on a button that went missing from the one winter coat she hasn't outgrown while she flutters around me, naked, arms raised, fingers twitching, a copper-colored snowstorm firmly keeping her eyes on the prize, which in this case is my right hand. No matter how often we play this, she simply cannot believe I will actually prick myself and let real blood drop on the floor. And there it comes, the red, the not quite white, and the brown vinyl window frame of our retelling the story. In the original, the color scheme is described as red, white, and black, like a Yemeni flag or the one from Trinidad and Tobago, but there aren't any mountains or forests in Chicago, just a small neighborhood park down the street and a few birds come spring. Within seconds, she morphs from blizzard to royal baby. I don't die yet because we play an early version of the tale, the one I grew up with, where it's the actual birth mother, not the stepmother, who gravely begrudges her offspring and readies herself for murder. There's one more version prior to that, where the king, not the queen, sits idle and longs for a daughter until he gets his wish granted. The child grows up by his side and crowds out the mother, rides next to him in the carriage's passenger seat, available to give him advice on how he can best steer his business. A bit like the current U.S. president situation, but we don't talk about him.
Some tales are simply too gruesome. And anyway, there's no king in our house. I confer with the mirror. Let it affirm me that I am the fairest, which I am in a dimly lit hallway. And then I summon infanticide instincts from God knows where in the depths of my maternal soul. Off I lead her into the forest, bread knife in hand. Twice in my past have I been assaulted, at night on a beach and in a gloomy hotel room, but never in the woods. On both occasions, the assailant was a man, but not a hunter of the deer stalking kind. I gently poke her flat chest with my knife and tell her to run as fast as she can. And she circles the dining room table at breakneck speed. And I worry she might run her forehead into one of its wooden corners while I calmly eat beets and let red juice drool over my chin, which makes her laugh every time. Last month, we bought actual liver from a Polish butcher on Lincoln Avenue. Not an easy find in the city. And ate it together, marveled at how unappealing the gray meat looked, how repelling its texture was, grainy, like compressed sand, tasting of blood, no matter how thoroughly we spiced and fried it. I've never eaten heart, and never will. I know my mother has in the past, just not mine. We go through the motions at the dwarf's house, but don't spend too much effort on it. All seven of them seem rather dull. A final decision on what their profession should be has yet to be made. Digging through gold mines seems a bit far-fetched. Animal shelter wardens, Airbnb hosts, faculty in a clown school. We've tried it all, but honestly, we don't like them, no matter their trade. For all we care, they could be parking lot attendants, no offense. The only thing going for them in their favor is their resourcefulness and an affinity for communal living, and also the fact that dwarfs don't die. The murderous mother comes and goes in disguise, comes back a third time, the one part in the play when I, too, get nervous. I hand my daughter the apple piece covered in chocolatey poison, deep in her eye, and she gives me a barely perceptible nod. I'll be careful. I'll only pretend choke. Once she actually did, but not on an apple, on a piece of carrot and in a different game. During the ride to the hospital, it was an ambulance, not a carriage. Her life hung on a thread I hadn't spun. And no matter how much the van jolted over potholes, it couldn't miraculously knock the carrot out of her throat. Snow White had fared better, fell ill deep in the forests of a country with a solidly state-sponsored health care plan, whereas my child's choking ended up costing me a small fortune. So she takes the apple. I trust her. Complicit, we roll our eyes, smirk at Snow White's naivety. How can any woman in her right mind be so utterly bereft of suspicion and fall for evil three times in a row? She crawls into her casket. I sprinkle cutouts of drawn birds around her. They gather to mourn and will stay put for the next 100 migrating seasons. Each time we play, there are more. She lies under the cellophane, eyes closed. And I can answer some emails. When her eyelids flutter and she checks on the depths of my longing, I stare lovingly back at her. On days when kindergarten was rough, a viral infection is imminent, or I can somehow sense she needs extra attention, I massage her head to toe, a treatment less than 4 feet long, until she lets go of the apple. She decides when this game is over, and sometimes we thicken and thin out the plot's final scene, let it dead end into other tales, or it seeps right through them. If she encountered rhinos, for example,
while she fled through the forest, we might end up with Ionesco and his tale of how fascism rises from nowhere. I realize I should talk to her about the current political climate. We bend the inevitability of the original story, and in the process, she learns the different types of waiting, sleep being one of them, and about how not to fall prey to temptation, and that a lack of shelter or friends can be synonymous with death. Tonight, before bed, I will tell her that someone else's affection can give you back what you thought was forever lost, but that truly is a miracle when it happens. Never count on one single guy. By then, she's eaten more than the recommended servings of veggies per day and has paid close attention to birds, something our neighborhood is almost bereft of. She's gained an appreciation for forests that are crowded with elves and trolls, even though the parking lot outside our front door is crowded only with cars. Game over. We turn on the music because we have to dance at the end. And in this tale, it's the only way to ensure that evil dies.
Is Not Like Other Girls by Lizzie Milton, and it will be read by Arden Fitzroy. Lizzie Milton is a playwright and storyteller making queer feminist theatre. Most recently, her show, 10 Stories, 5 Performers, 1 Riotous Celebration of History's Heroines, had a sold-out run at Vault Festival in early 2019. She has an MA in Writing for Performance and Dramaturgy from Goldsmiths. Arden Fitzroy is an actor, writer, and full-time dandy who believes in experimentation and blurring the boundaries of genre, gender, and art forms. Arden has performed on stages far and wide, from festivals to cabarets, from music halls to drag halls, and from the traditional boards to dragon hordes. Find her later to ask more about that. Find him in the guise of Don Giovanni at the Arcola Theatre this autumn. Welcome, Arden Fitzroy.
Not Like Other Girls by Elizabeth Milton. Dad was a bit surprised when Mum gave birth to 1 million spiders. Everyone was. I mean, they would be. Giving birth to 1 million spiders is not typical. The thing about giving birth to 1 million spiders, the reason spiders give birth to 1 million spiders, is that most of them will die. Sometimes they crawl off to seek their fame and fortune in foreign lands, but mostly they just die. This was exactly what happened with Mum and Dad, which, as you can imagine, for them was a bloody relief. What do you do with 1 million spiders? Granted, on a 1-to-1 ratio, one spider is much lower maintenance than one baby, but 1 million, that's a lot of spiders. Fortunately, Mum and Dad were left with just me crawling up my mum's left arm. They didn't have any clothes appropriate for spiders and weren't quite sure how to explain to friends and family that Mum had given birth to 1 million spiders, most of whom had died, so they just didn't. They acted like everything was normal. And if anyone noticed that I had a suspicious amount of limbs for a baby, or that bouncing baby girls don't normally discharge webbing from their abdomen, they were too polite to say anything. School was okay. I was good at maths. I like counting things. I didn't have many friends, mostly because options were limited. Okay, I was a giant arachnid in a pinafore, but Chris Martin used to pick his own snot and eat it afterwards. I'm not sure I even have a nose. I was aware that other kids' diets didn't solely consist of the liquefied remains of flies, and they didn't spend their spare time creating elaborate webs, only to have them walk through 5 minutes later, but it was okay. Everyone is unique, right? Netball was hard. I have this embarrassing habit of standing completely still when fast objects come towards me. My thinking is that if I stand still, then no one will be able to see me. That is not how balls work, or sight, for that matter. You would think having more limbs would be beneficial, but they're actually quite difficult to coordinate. Imagine a spider trying to juggle. It's tragic, isn't it? Fun fact about me. I don't have muscles or a skeletal frame like you do. I actually move through hydraulics. So if you dropped me from a tall height, I would explode a bit like a water balloon, but please don't do that. It was at college that I felt it. Other girls didn't seem to want to talk to me. I tried to fit in. I wore shorter skirts and put on mascara, which is a lot more time consuming when you have 8 of the little bastards. I even worked out how to blow dry all of the hair along my body into a fashionable feathered look. I looked like 80s Madonna if Madonna was a giant spider. Still, no one wanted to talk to me. No one wanted to talk to me until I met Charlie. We were sat at the kitchen table of a freshers' party, not making eye contact. Charlie was short, androgynous looking, and had a voice like a whisper. She was very good at not making eye contact. We sat there for over an hour, not talking or looking at each other. We're getting this really comfortable silence going when she leans in all conspiratorially and whispers, "I'm not like other girls." "You mean you're..." Charlie nods sagely. "Me too," I say. "I thought so. How long have you been?" "All my life," I say. Charlie smiles. "Me too," she says. "I have found my kin, my tribe. I am not the only giant spider pretending to be human." "Which team do you support?"
"Sorry, what?"
"I support Arsenal. Which team do you support?" "Sorry, we were talking about not being like other girls. I don't quite..." "Yeah, I like football." "Oh, cool, yeah. Yeah, me too. Definitely not the giant spider posing as one."
"So which team do you support?"
Team A. I support Team A." "Fun fact about me. I don't have veins or arteries like you do. Instead, my organs are just doused in blood flowing freely around my body. This means if you threw me from a tall height when I exploded like a water balloon, it would be a delightful pinky red colour. But again, please don't do that." At the end of the third year, I go on a date. I have gone on dates before this, but not like this one. Not like Alex. Alex has swishy hair and eyes that are too big for his face. His words are sharp and clean, and he also does not like eye contact. Or physical contact, for that matter. But he likes me. "You're not like other girls," he says matter-of-factly. Oh shit, he's found me out. With Charlie, I was excited. It could have been a bonding experience, but I'm fairly positive most boys would not be pleased to find out their potential new girlfriend is a giant spider posing as a woman. That is news that would not go down well. What gave me away? Was it the 8 legs? The silk webbing that occasionally oozes from my abdomen? The fact that every man I've slept with before has mysteriously disappeared? Oh, I kill them, that's why. I wrap them up in webbing, liquefy their bodies, and suck them up like a tasty man's smoothie. It's disgusting, I know, but who can say they've never done something weird in the heat of the moment? Alex, said again, you're not like other girls. A potent pause. I bet you like football. Fun facts about me. I'm a big fan of the mathematical work of Leibniz. Just because I'm a giant spider posing as a woman doesn't mean I can't have layers. Eventually, I do find other giant spiders posing as people, but most of them work in Hollywood, and I'm training to be an accountant. I like counting things. So we don't really have much in common. Accountancy isn't the most spider-aware workplace, but we're working on it. It's not easy being a giant spider posing as a woman, but it's getting easier. We have friends now. On Thursday, me and Janet from HR play badminton. And the other day, Brenda, our IT person, said my shoes really brought out all eight of my eyes. I still find dating hard. I think it's something to do with the whole being killed and eaten afterwards that really puts men off. You know what men are like about commitment. I still always listen in extra hard when I hear a woman say she's not like other girls. Because I know, better than any, there's always the smallest chance she really isn't.
End of the first half.
Liam says I have to shout at you. Welcome back!
Thank you. So, I have some amazing questions here for our amazing quiz, because the prizes are amazing. Modelled by Liam here. So, the way it works is, if you know the answer to the question, you can hear me, yeah?
Yes.
Thank you. If you know the answer to the question, raise your hand and shout, power to the girls.
Can we give it a try? Yeah. One, two, three.
Power to the girls.
And then you get to choose which book you want.
Assuming you get the right answer.
Yeah. Not just from having shouted.
Yeah, exactly. That would be too easy. Right, so we have five books. A lovely mixer. We have, let's start with the five. We have 5x5, which is an Arachne anthology, including Katie Darby, who isn't here tonight, but is normally doing what I've been doing with the buttons and the machines, etc.
She's also the god of lies.
She is the queen.
That's right, goddess.
Goddess, whatever, it doesn't matter. She is Lisley. So we have that one.
Thank you.
We have a signed copy of One Thing by Xanthi Barker, which is a little chapbook from OpenPen. And there's a message to the successful question answer.
It's also signed by Xanthi Barker.
That's what I said.
You said that, didn't you?
Yeah. We have The Bad Mother. Ooh. Even the best parent in the world isn't always perfect. By Isabel Gray. She builds the emotional suspense with white-hot intensity, says Elizabeth Buchan on Out of Sight. We have The Silent Companions. It's a hardback. Can I get an ooh? By Laura Purcell. Compelling and claustrophobic. The pages all but turn by themselves. Now that would be
terrifying.
And we have an admittedly slightly Fox copy. It wasn't Fox this morning, due to a small accident with my lunch.
So in a way, also signed by Liam Hogan.
It's marked by me. I don't think it's signed. The Truth Witch by Susan Denard. This book will delight you, and the smell is quite precious.
What did you have for lunch?
I'll let people who win the book work that out themselves. In a continent on the edge of war, two witches hold its fate in their hands. There we go. It's quite a lot of blurb. I'm not going to read it all. So,
I want you seeing you trying to work out.
I was going to go. Is there a bit I should? No. Rich, dynamic storytelling. Breathtaking. Right.
Excellent. So we remember what we're shouting? Name either of the youngest Bronte sisters' novels.
Powers of Girls. And Tenet of Wildfell Hall.
Yes! That's it, you've won a book!
Which of the books would you like?
Who is the only woman to win the Booker twice? Virginia Woolf's 1929 essay, A Room of One's Own. Who liked who?
That's got the battle. You can guess, you just might embarrass yourself. Nope, have we got a spare?
Yeah. Do you want to know the answer?
Yes.
Chloe liked Olivia. The
audience didn't react to that.
There was nothing. There was nothing. So I decided not to react to the audience. Which 6th century poet did Plato call the 10th muse?
Powerful Girls?
Yeah. Sabbath? Yeah! You get me as well. Well done. Thank you all. All right, thanks. Well done, Liam.
Yay!
Story of our second half is called The Man in the End Terrace, and it's by Catherine Edmonds, and it will be read by Gloria Sanders. Catherine Edmonds is a writer, artist, and folk rock fiddle player. Her published works include 2 poetry collections, 4 novels, and a Holocaust memoir. She has been nominated 3 times for a Pushcart Prize, shortlisted in the Bridport 4 times, and has worked in journal and has works in journals including Aesthetica, Cranog, and Ambit.
Gloria Sanders trained at drama studio in London. She regularly narrates audiobooks for the RNIB and recently joined the cast of Time Will Tell's Dracula at Whitby Abbey. She often works as an historical interpreter at heritage sites around the country and has continued her training in clowning and historic performing. Welcome to the stage, myself. The Man in the End Terrace by Catherine Edmonds. South Cleveland is more street than village. Two rows of mean terraces facing each other, built 100 years ago for the men at the pit that closed as soon as it opened. Out back, there's the Nettie, and then the farmer's fields. Cheryl's dog got lost in the fields one time. Her brother said the tractor ran it over. It got sliced up in the machinery and spattered all over the place. Cheryl's brother found this very funny. So she told him the owl that sat on the fence post would peck his eyes out. And Cheryl's brother said, fuck off, and took a Stella out the fridge. But ever since then, he looks warily at the fence post whenever he passes it. Mam is used to all of this. She's had years of it with a succession of kids. These two are the last. Cheryl's growing up fast. She's a bright lass, she'll be fine. As for the lad, he'll go the way of all the lads here if he can't find work. But there's nothing she can do about that. Cheryl will keep him right. An artist has moved into the end of the terrace. He wears little round glasses and says, hello. No one else says hello. They say, fuck off, if they're kids or now then, if they're old and wanting to be friendly. The artist sits out in the field with an easel and paints, but like Cheryl's told her mum, he can't be a proper artist because he doesn't paint what's there. It's all daft shapes and the wrong colours. Today, he's done a slash of red right across the canvas, but there's nothing red in the field. Wrong time of year for poppies. There's just an ache of coal dust and loss which breaks her heart. So Cheryl loses patience with his wrongness. She kicks his easel to the ground, stamps on the canvas and screams at him. The man backs off, hands raised, and says very slowly, I'm sorry. I don't understand what you're saying. Like she's a foreigner or something. That's actually bloody funny because Cheryl's not exactly like everyone else around here, though she covers it up well. She turns around quickly so he can't see her laughing and runs over to tell her mum. She's still giggling when she launches herself through the door. Mam's peering at a tiny book, but she closes it, pops it in her pocket, smiles up at her daughter. Cheryl says she thinks she's frightened the artist. And Mam says, what'd you do that for? But she isn't cross. She says, he probably deserved it. His type, what do you expect? Cheryl wonders what his type thinks about. And Mam says, probably the best way to iron his socks. And they splutter with laughter. But Mam says she really shouldn't have spoiled the man's painting. Cheryl starts filling up. She can't help it. But Mam gives her a hug and it's all fine. Cheryl's brother comes in, swings the fridge door open and gets out a Stella, pulls the ring and it snaps off so he swears, and gets a hammer and a huge nail, and Mam shakes her head, but she catches Cheryl's eye, and her brother doesn't notice, too busy. The can splatters open at last, and he's exultant, he's a hero. He leans back against the table, drinking it with his Adam's apple. He leans back against the table, drinking it with his Adam's apple bobbing up and down. And that sets Cheryl off again, so she runs out into the field and lies on the grass, ribs aching. She wonders if the artist is lonely and might be like. She might be only 16, but she's done it often enough to know all men are different. Some are kind and funny, some are rough. Most are idiots. They'll do exactly what you want if you speak to them.
Cheryl's picked up plenty of tips over the years. Mum's still popular and she does very nicely, thank you very much, so they're always able to pay the lackey. The next time the artist is painting outdoors, Cheryl goes and watches. The artist looks worried when he sees her, but he's too busy painting his shapes and slashes to stop. Cheryl finds if she squints, she can see there's something about the coloured marks that really does describe the day, the sun beating down on the fields and the crows in the trees and even the chirping grasshoppers. She can't work out how he's doing it, so she forgets about imagining what he'd be like and watches the art instead. And after a bit, she decides art is better than sex when it's done this way. She says as much to the man and he fumbles with his brushes and drops them on the ground. She helps him pick them up and hands them back, and he says, thank you. Very polite and proper. She's brought a couple of cans and asks if he'd like one, but he says, no thanks, not while he's painting, and she says, mind if I do? And he's like, be my guest. And he smiles, and she feels dead grown up. This is nice. This isn't South Cleetland at all. This is the south of France. She says so. And the sun's baking down, and he says, that's very deceptive. Yes. I've always loved Suzanne. I'm so pleased it shows. She doesn't know what the fuck he's on about. But it doesn't matter. She'll have him, and it'll be nice. But no rush. She's dead careful to talk proper now, so he'll understand. She tells him about the owl, but not about it pecking her brother's eyes out. She talks about her mum and about love, and about how they got boots in their house, and there's not many can say that. There's even one with poems. And she says how her dog ran away across the field, and her brother said the thresher had got it, and then it was splattered all over the place. That's why the red slash on his painting upset her, and she's dead sorry about spoiling it. He says he understands. He actually talks to her properly, like a man does. He says he used to be married, but his wife had had a miscarriage, and that was what he'd been painting, the pain and the bleeding. They'd separated afterwards. There was too much hurt. Cheryl doesn't know how to reply. She thinks she's going to cry because she remembers when that happened to her mum. So she walks up close and puts her arm around his shoulder, just like her mum does when Cheryl's upset about something. The artist stays very still for a while, but then he carries on painting and doesn't shake her off. His shoulder is hot and she likes how the muscles in his back move as he brushes the colours across the canvas. He finishes and he says how intensely beautiful this place is. And she's like, what, South Cleetland? Fuck off! But she doesn't say it out loud. She thinks what her mum's like when one of her favourite gentlemen calls round. The softness in her eyes, the way she takes his hand. She helps the artist pack up and carry the stuff back to his cottage. And he asks if she'd like to come in, so she does. And he makes up a jug of some drink with lemonade and chopped up oranges and mint leaves and blue flowers. It's sweet and delicious and bursting with colours. She means flavours. But with this bloke, it's colours. It's always colours. And she puts a glass down and takes his hand and leads him upstairs. All the terraces are the same. She knows where to go. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, they're under the sheets. And the sun is beaming in through the window and somewhere a fox is shouting and the kids are doing a skipping game in the street and it's the most perfect time ever and nothing will ever be so wonderful again. She kisses him once, so lightly he barely stirs, and then she leaves quietly and goes back home. Mum is making chips. Where have you been all afternoon? With the artist. Mum looks out the window and doesn't say anything. Then, I knew a man who wrote books once. She goes to the shelf and takes one down, leafs through the pages. There's a slip of paper. She reads it and smiles, then puts it back. Cheryl doesn't say anything. She sits
very still. It was before you were born. It was clever. Too clever for me. We only did it the one time. But it was the best. The bluebells were out. Shovel thinks about this for a bit. How long was that before I was born? Mam pours herself a Stella, stares at the bubbles, wipes the condensation with one finger. You're pretty clever yourself, she says, and she laughs, shakes her head, and gets a bucket of burgers out the freezer. She writes short stories and flash fiction and has completed her first novel. She has had stories chosen for Liars League and been listed for awards including Bath Flash and TSS Flash Fiction. Her first short play was staged last year and has since been adapted into a short film. Carrie Cohen's theatre includes Sandra in TikTok, Penny in Black Star, both at the Arcola Theatre, Slam Minutes at the Pleasance, and Mrs. Tarleton in Miss Alliance at the Tabard. Recent film includes the lead roles of Grace in Just Saying and Rose in Skeletons. Radio includes the lead role of Ziggy in Retribution for Right Hour Drama Podcast. Welcome to the stage, Carrie Cohen.
May be the last typesetter in England. And like the last speaker of a tribal language, I am increasingly in a world of my own. I speak of ink levels and typefaces, margins and frames, and the young activists nod at me, but they can't really grasp it. Oh, they've seen printed works, of course, exquisite books in libraries and newspapers in museums. Architects from a more beautiful and a more primitive age. Metal, ink, paper. To think we once had to cut down forests to share our stories. The clamour of presses. Oh, the stink of chemicals. Now knowledge is passed through the air, invisible, silent, clean. Clouds of words and images. Where does it come from? Who knows? Who cares? We are all the generators of content now. Light fades from south to north in winter and also from east to west. Out here in the reeds and mud of the estuary, it is possible to time it by the caroling of the terns and the gulls rising up as the sun falls away. Winter is our time. We crave the darkness and we cannot show lights out here. This hour of dusk is our window. An hour is all we really have in any case. If we do not interact with the web at least once every 90 minutes, an alarm goes off somewhere. I don't know where it is, and it's probably not a real geographical place, but somewhere in the system, an alert, a tag is generated against a string of code, and they will start to monitor more closely. We leave our devices where we can best retrieve them later, at home, in back panniers in Greenwich Station, or inside a decrepit concrete garage close to the Tilbury Dock. Wherever we can ditch them, but not all together. That would make a cluster, and clusters also attract increased monitoring. But now we are off the grid, out of the net, and as close to freedom as is possible in this world. For the next hour, the system does not know where we are. This evening, we are expecting two deliveries, one coming upriver from Canby Island and one coming down. I am the first receiver, lying flat in the wet grass in the dying day, clammy inside waterproofs, listening for the skim of oars on the water. They won't risk the outboard so close to the shore. Patrols are few, but they are known to shoot on sight to deter people smugglers. The migrants still come, although there's no point without a device. The system will pick them up as soon as they try to interact or transact. I think of Dickens and Magwitch and prison hulks on the river, some of them still sunk out there in the mud. These marshes, lawless and abandoned then and now, again, become a place of renegades and outcasts. Oh, the barrier failed, and the sea reclaimed the floodplains. The city is retreating west now, and north and south to higher ground. The boat comes so quiet that I almost miss it. An inky shadow against the grey twilight. The crew manoeuvres it to the shore, just a slightly drier hummock on the edge of the flats. I know these women by reputation. The dragon boat captain from Oxford and a fish gutter on leave from the offshore trawlers out of Grimsby who carries a knife strapped to her thigh. I am a flabby old bird by comparison with at least 30 years on the oldest of them. I wade over and steady the ancient wooden skiff. Fish gutter nods and passes me the waterproof pouch. It's too big to go into my pocket, so I remove the velvet bag and hand the pouch back. Can we see? She says. You didn't look? No. Direct into your hands, we was told. We check the horizons on all sides. Nothing. I open the drawstring and spill them onto my hand. Three of them. J, Q, and W. Golden letters lying in my palm. They stare at them. Dragon boat touches J with the tip of her finger. Beautiful. J and Q have travelled all the way from Uganda. W found under the floorboards of an abandoned works in Leipzig. I wrap them carefully and zip them into the inside pocket of my fleece. When? Soon. I'd like to share more. Their courage is immense. To slip through the shipping channel takes time, hours out of the net. Alerts will be raised, monitoring applied. I push the boat off and in seconds they disappear into the cold. A light fog is swimming, hopefully, up the river. I check back to the garage and hand over my cargo. Any news?
Heard they're landing in Gravesend.
The final piece. If we succeed tonight, we will soon have a working press. A thought is exhilarating. Knowledge and ideas printed on paper, passed hand to hand, shared but not monitored, outside the system. I retrieve my device. 35 minutes until I need to interact. Enough time to get back to Greenwich at least and fall in with the evening commuters. Check the weather or some other innocuous transaction. What we are doing is dangerous, seditious even. You can't just walk into a shop and buy paper. You can't order it on the net. It is contraband. Purchase of materials likely to be of use to terrorists. You're innocent, you've nothing to hide. I board a train at Greenwich, buy a coffee at London Bridge. Get back on the grid. But a boat is landing at Gravesend. Soon, the clatter of words will spill out again onto pamphlets, posters, news sheets. Unmonitored, anonymous, free.
And before our sixth and final story of the night, our next deadline for what you're thinking of submitting is the 1st of September, and the theme is Toil and Trouble. Witches, warlocks, wizards. How do you say wivens? Wyverns? Wyverns. Whites, race, and I'm going to stop there. But that date of the evening, that date of the evening, will be October the 8th, and obviously on the Liars League website. Did someone just say wizards? No. So you can check out the website. Also, all of the videos of all the readings will get uploaded, so if you enjoyed tonight so much, then you can look at last year's Women and Girls for more. Alright, so, where is she? There she is. Our next story is Kind, Intelligent, Generous by Georgie Melrose, and it will be read by Annalie Wilson. Georgie Melrose is the author of Kind, Intelligent, Generous, which is her first published work. As an Australian on a post-university gap year in London, Georgie spends her days making flatbites at her local cafe, thank you, and reading novels she wishes she had written. Annalie Wilson is an actor, musician, and award-winning singer-songwriter. Her new project, Luna Beck, launched this summer and was described as relatable and inspirational by Get Into This magazine and also by me. Please check her out. It is beautiful. And a great singer-songwriter to watch by the Strange Brew podcast. Welcome, Annalie.
Intelligent, Generous, by Georgie Melrose. I knew Adam wasn't the one when I found out that he didn't think I was funny. It's not something people usually just come out and say. I guess that's how I dated the man for 3 years without realising. When he told me, which I'll get to, it hit me that in life we all operate in our own siloed off worlds. Connection occurs as much within our heads as it does in reality. I blundered around for years laughing at Adam's jokes, thinking that the kind, intelligent, and generous man I was with also had a sense of humour. The realisation he didn't was like a glass of cold water to the face, followed quickly by another when I realised he had never understood my sparkling wit. So I left him. The demise of my and Adam's relationship began one morning over cereal when I asked, "What do you think my top three traits are?" This might sound like a strange conversation topic, but sometimes you have to throw a curveball into the mix when you're in a long-term relationship or things get a bit stale. He crunched on his all bran, perhaps the least humorous cereal, and said, "Ooh, that's a tough one." Some milk dribbled out of his lips. "Tough to think of three good things about me? That's a bad sign," I joked. No, it's just tough to decide which of the many good things about you go in the top three," he said. I laughed, as though there weren't actually lots of good things about me to choose from. "Well, I guess the top one would be your kindness, and second would be your intelligence. Third, your generosity." He smiled at me with affection and a tinge of smugness, as though he had just passed a test with flying colours. Eat breakfast, tick. Pass test set by a neurotic girlfriend, tick. Go to work, tick. As I scrubbed our cereal bowls at the sink, I seethed. Kindness. Intelligence. Generosity. I felt like he had taken my subversive, interesting personality and rendered me as some kind of benevolent, sexless Mother Teresa. I wasn't kind. Arguably, I was mean, if I had to be described as one or the other. Thank God he included intelligence. But did he really think I was intelligent? Or did he just say it because it's what you say? I washed the dregs of his stupid all-bran down the sink, feeling unseen. Then I headed to the shower. Kindness. The next morning, over cereal, Adam ate all bran as usual, but mixed in some untoasted muesli just to keep things fun. I asked Adam to tell me why he thought I was kind. "Of course you're kind. I wouldn't love you if you weren't kind," he said, as though his say-so was enough. "But what about all the mean things I say to people we know? Like when I told Shauna that she has an ugly name." "Shauna does have an ugly name. Besides, you didn't do that to be mean, did you?" I reflected. I had said it because I was bored by the dull couple's barbecue we were at, and it had struck me as a funny topic of conversation, names. When I got a few shocked laughs, I had elaborated on the theme and then got carried away, like a comedian who has found the audience's sweet spot. "In general, you're a good person," Adam continued. "You pay taxes, you help your clients. That is such a banker's idea of what makes a good person. Paying taxes is very important." Before he could begin his standard tirade on taxation, I said, "The goodness isn't kindness." "Well, what about the women's legal stuff? You volunteered there. An unkind person wouldn't do that." He picked up his bowl and drank the remaining milk. "I love how the milk goes all sweet when I have muesli," he said. As I put on my makeup in the steamy bathroom after breakfast, I felt frustrated. I smoothed foundation onto my face until my skin was monochromatic, and then painted on blush and lipstick as if to say, "There's still blood in this face. I'm still alive." I took out my nose ring and put in a clear placeholder stud. Then I went to work. I work in a glossy high-rise in the city. I wear flats on the train and change into heels in the alleyway downstairs. I sit at a desk, not my desk, we hot desk, and process apartment sales in large-scale residential developments that haven't been built yet. My clients are all property developers and only care about one thing, money. Once, I had to write to a terminally ill person to tell them we wouldn't give them their deposit back, even though their recent diagnosis meant they were likely to die before their apartment was ready. My supervisor went through the letter I drafted to the terminally ill person and crossed out my first sentence. "We are so sorry to hear about your recent diagnosis." I didn't even protest when I saw her edits. Just made the changes and sent it back. It's not what I planned, but Adam got me the job through a friend when I couldn't find anything on my own. The non-profit sector is more competitive than you'd think. Mm-hmm. Intelligence. I met Adam through a mutual friend while I was still at uni.
He had graduated several years before and worked in finance, which he treated like it was no big deal. "I work at a bank, doing money stuff," he said to me when I asked him what he did. But let's not dwell on that. I found his nonchalance charming. It felt like we had shared a joke and his career was the punchline. "What about you?" he said, pushing his straw to the side so he could drink his vodka and tonic straight from the glass. "I'm studying law." He nodded. "Oh, great." His voice was so monotone that it was impossible to tell whether he was extremely serious or sarcastic. He continued, "Any area you're particularly interested in?" "Why don't you guess?" I said, making a fuss of sipping my drink through the straw. "Okay, well, judging from the look you gave me when I said I'm in finance, I guess you're not into commercial law or tax or anything like that." I smiled. "Go on." "And, not that I want to stereotype, but this is your game." I held up my hands in surrender. "No, don't worry. Judge away. From your nose ring and your style, I'd say you're a lefty. So maybe human rights?" "Not exactly. Do you want another guess? Now go on, you tell me." "Probably, and I'm really not sure, but I'd probably like to work in a women's legal centre, either in DV, domestic violence, or family law." "So I was pretty close," he said. "Kind of, at least insofar as women are humans and I care about their rights." "Well, that and the fact that you want to make a difference." He made bunny ears with his fingers as though wanting to make a difference was a cliche. "Hey, don't mock me. Am I that predictable?" I said. "No, not at all. I'm just a good judge of character." He smiled, his beautiful straight teeth fully visible like a shark's. I thought how much I'd like to kiss his mouth, just for a laugh, just to see whether finance people could be passionate. Or that's what I tell my friends. But they'd probably get it. He was handsome, tanned and muscular, and confident. I found him intriguing. Why was he here with all these uni students rather than at a trendy bar with his banker friends? I reasoned, from his aversion to talking about work, that it was probably because he found them, and it, as contemptible as I did, that he had a secret inner desire to work as a creative or a philanthropist. I saw in him what I wanted to see. We started sleeping together the next week, and a year later, when I graduated, we still were. So I moved in. Generosity. I should have been prepared to answer the question when Adam asked me what his best three traits were, but I'd been lost in my own crisis and hadn't given it a thought. When he asked me on Wednesday morning, I said, "Well, for starters, you smell excellent." I rubbed my nose into his neck. "You love the Chanel, what can I say?" I went back to my Rice Krispies with sugar on top. "You are very healthy," I said, eyeing his all brown, "and consistent. Look at you, eating the same cereal day after day. Don't you ever get bored?" "I do. Sometimes I have it with muesli. But I've got to stick with it. I need the fibre to get things moving." He looked at me matter-of-factly, like we weren't discussing his shit. "You sound like an ad for Allbran." "I'm passionate about Allbran, even if I'm a bit bored of it." "Isn't that a contradiction?" He ignored me. "Now come on, I want a third trait. I've got fragrant, reliable..." "I said healthy too. Come on, Mia. I'm fishing for at least one compliment here." I laughed, as though I hadn't become immune to all the good things about him, as though they hadn't become lost in the routines we shared and the people we seemed to have become. "You're funny," I said. "Well, not always laugh out loud, but you're humorous, witty. We both are. I've always thought of it as our thing." "Really?" he said. "I've never thought of us as funny people." After Adam left, I went into our bedroom to dress.
He didn't think we were funny? I couldn't believe that I was with someone who didn't think being funny was important. Who didn't see that the little jokes we shared were the only way that I could connect my world to his. I pulled on a pencil skirt and floral blouse and assessed the outfit in the mirror, sucking in my tummy and pulling my shoulders back. I wondered, what does Adam see when he looks at me? The note I left on the breakfast table said, I'm rude, sometimes selfish and funny. And I want someone who sees that and loves me anyway.
Joining us. Give another huge cheer for our authors. And also for our wonderful actors. And that's it. You may go home to bed now. Thank you. Thank you.